Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news. But stand by now for the Worldview. It is The Worldview, and I am Doug McBurney, your humble host, coming to you as we look forward by looking back at the news of the week. This is the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you back. And I'm doing the show this evening from a reclined position because my exuberance has once again exceeded my physical capabilities. I was out in Las Vegas, oddly enough, looking for work. And I had an opportunity to visit Mike, the Vegas economist, who's a friend of mine, and an eternal optimist, I must say. Mike the economist is the eternal optimist. So optimistic is Mike that he has installed on his estate a beach volleyball court. That's right, a beach volleyball court surrounded by pine trees with sand and a volleyball net. Everything but the ocean. It's gorgeous. So with the volleyball court freshly installed, we set out to inaugurate it. And Mike invited over some 20-somethings who work for him and friends of his daughter to inaugurate the volleyball court. And I rolled up there. And I see them out there playing, and I sat down and just watched. And about half a Corona in, I decided I'm going to go ahead and play. So I changed into beach attire, and well, played three games of volleyball. And at the end of the third game, I planted my left foot deep in the sand, and my torso went one way, and my knee and ankle remained fixed in place. And I collapsed to the ground. A heap of geezing pain. It was a tragedy of epic proportion. And I am still recovering. But the next day, I went to work. I limped through the day. I should say I went looking for work. I showed up and let them know that I play hurt. Anyway, I'm paying for that now. Got the ankle in a brace. I'm in a reclined position, but I am not on any pain-killing drugs as of this moment because I want to be clear-headed as I present the weekly worldview to you. And so let's get to the news of the week. We're going to start in New Orleans from the Associated Press. Where's the oil is the headline from this AP story. They tell us that for a spill now nearly half the size of the Exxon Valdez, the oil from the Deepwater Horizon disaster is pretty hard to pin down. The spill is 23 days old since the Deepwater Horizon exploded, you'll remember, back on April 20th, by the way, killing 11 workers. And the thickest oil hasn't shown up on the coast yet, despite the dire predictions and the fact that CNN has people stationed all the way from Tallahassee to New Orleans just waiting for the black waves to engulf all the pretty white birds down there so they can get it on camera. They've been down there for, more than 3 weeks now just waiting for the disaster. And the disaster just has not come yet. So where's the oil, asks the AP reporter, and where's it going to end up? Well, there seems to be no consensus on whether it will arrive in black waves, mostly dissipate into the massive gulf, or gradually settle to the ocean floor, where it could seep into the ecosystem for years. Didn't it come from the ecosystem? Oil's not part of the ecosystem? Maybe I don't understand. I guess there's certain places you don't want oil, and perhaps the ocean floor is one of them. And, well, we'll certainly find out, I suppose. One analytical tool used by experts to determine what's going to happen in this impending disaster suggests that more than a third of the oil may already be out of the water. Yeah, about 35% of the spill, they say, would simply evaporate. Evaporate. Yeah, that's right. The model also suggests that virtually all the benzene, which is the toxic flammable chemical compound in the oil, would be stripped off and quickly vaporized, just drift off into the air. And the size and nature of the spill has been altered by response efforts by evil humans. Yes, about 436,000 gallons of chemicals have been sprayed on the oil to break it up. And about 4 million gallons of oily water have been recovered, of which about 10% is oil. And crews have burned a negligible quantity off the surface of the Gulf of Mexico. That would leave as much as 2.7 million gallons at sea as of this past Friday, with about 200,000 gallons a day coming up out of the damaged wellhead. Now, I wonder how many gallons of water there are in the Gulf of Mexico. I don't think they measure the water there in gallons. I think they measure it in cubic miles of water. And there's a number of them. So anyway, as I said earlier in the week, as I was sitting in on AM 670, the 50,000 watt Christian blowtorch of the Rocky Mountain West, I said that I've been praying and thanking God daily for the ecosystem he gave us, and just hoping that the ecosystem itself will prevent a major calamity there on the coastline. And of course, I'm no expert in the area, and I can't predict what will happen. But I'm amazed at the creation that God has put together and how amazing it works. And so let us pray and thank God for his awesome creation and hope for the best. All right, now, so moving from hoping to the best, let's move on to facing the worst. We'll go right to the justice file. In Santa Ana, California, authorities say a man about to be extradited from Canada to face charges in a 1984 murder apparently committed suicide after learning he would indeed be extradited. Now listen to what happened here. 53-year-old Gerald Sue Goh died last Thursday in Toronto. Now he was charged with murder in the 1984 killing of 38-year-old Elizabeth Hofschneider. A DNA match occurred in 2005 while Mr. Goh was in prison in America. So do you get that? He's in prison on an unrelated assault charge. A DNA match happens, connects him to a 1984 murder. He's in prison. So you'd think there's no chance this guy's going to get away, right? But the justice system had him deported to Canada in 2007 after finishing his sentence, at which point he fought extradition for the better part of the last 3 years and has eluded justice at the hands of men. Well, he committed suicide, so he's walked into justice at the hands of the living God, and let me tell you, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, Mr. Goh. See you on Judgment Day. Which for Mr. Goh would have been, he committed suicide. That would have been last Thursday for Mr. Goh. All right, now, on deeper into the justice file, this is out of San Diego. America's finest city, John Albert Gardner III, has been sentenced to two life terms without the possibility of parole for murdering Chelsea King and Amber Dubois, two young ladies, 17 and 14 years old, respectively. And a third life term was added with a 25-year minimum for the attempted assault of another teenager, Candace Moncayo, who escaped him by smashing him in the nose with an elbow and got away. Life in prison. He murdered two young girls and obviously was well on his way to at least assaulting, possibly murdering a third. But the justice system out in California is simply so overwhelmed with the crime epidemic that they've cut a deal with the devil. And they've allowed this man to live. One of the victims, Amber Dubois, Her backpack was filled with Valentine's Day cards for friends on the day she was abducted. The Future Farmers of America member was also carrying a check to buy a lamb on the day she was murdered by John Albert Gardner III, who has been granted life by the Just a System out in California. The killer, who reached a plea deal last month that spared him the death penalty, cried during a video about Amber's life. Well, I guess that makes it all worthwhile. He's obviously sorry. Unbelievable. How is it that we cannot agree that perpetrators of such heinous crimes should not be put to death? Have we lost our way to that degree? Have we lost our humanity? Does anyone understand how much this cheapens the life of every teenage girl in the world? By allowing someone who should not live to live, you make the lives of Chelsea King and Amber Dubois and Candace Moncayo, you make their lives worth less. You make the lives of every survivor walking around today worth less. And you embolden those who would victimize the weak. And that is not what the justice system is supposed to do, but it's not. It's just a system. We'll move on into the justice file to Cleveland. A Cleveland handyman has been sentenced to life in prison without parole for the crowbar beating deaths of two Polish immigrants. Crowbar beating deaths. A judge last Friday sentenced 58-year-old William Bryant to life in prison in a... It doesn't even say there was a plea deal here. The story does not have that many details, but let me give you one detail that you might find interesting. A couple of details, actually. Prosecutors say robbery was the motive behind the 2006 murders. The women had been sent to German forced labor camps during World War II and had survived Hitler's concentration camps. Beat to death with a crowbar in Cleveland by William Bryant, who will live. Who will live. All right, that's the justice file. I had to get that out of the way because I didn't want it. Well, it's depressing, frankly. And it should outrage you as an American. And certainly if you're a Christian, it should outrage you as a Christian. Because the death penalty is at the heart of the gospel. And when the government mocks the death penalty and misuses justice, they cheapen the gospel, which is a criminal act by our criminal government and our criminal just us system. Now let's move into the culture file. This is a story from the Daily Mail. Over in England, scientists are warning that rising levels of male infertility have become so perilous that it is a serious public health issue. Professor Niels Skakkebæk of the University of Copenhagen describes the issue as important as global warming. That's what Niels Skakkebæk in Copenhagen, he says it's important as global warming, this issue with male infertility. He says if this trend continues, it could indicate men are on the path to becoming completely infertile within a few generations. Scary stuff, right? But wait, I would hesitate. Wouldn't start freaking out yet. I want to know, is there any significant grant money being offered to study male infertility? I mean, the guy compared it to global warming, which is one of the biggest scams, probably the biggest scam in history, except for the theory of unguided macroevolution in the origins of man, and the idea that a woman has a right to privacy that allows her to murder another innocent person. Those are two bigger scams than global warming. But global warming's right up there, and global warming is the scam is primarily promulgated by those seeking grant money from foundations and governments. So before we start freaking out about male infertility, I just want to know, someone needs to sniff out the grant money there. No, there was no grant money involved in promulgating the theory of evolution. And there was no grant money in convincing the world that a woman's right to privacy gave her the right to murder another innocent person. There was other motivations there beyond money. But that's a whole nother show. Maybe we'll get back to that a little later when we get into the personhood file. But for now, let's continue into the culture file as we witness the collapse of Western civilization before our very eyes. According to Reuters, nearly 40 million Americans received food stamps in the latest quarter reported. 40 million. Food stamps are the primary federal anti-hunger program helping poor people buy food. So the Agriculture Department says that 1 in 8 Americans are currently enrolled for food stamps. And they've given it a new name, SNAP. SNAP. That's to keep up with the hip-hop culture or something. They now call it SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And research suggests, now listen to this. So it's stunning that 40 million Americans, 1 in 8, are on food stamps. That's shocking to me. A bit disquieting. But research done there at the Agriculture Department suggests that 1 in 3 who are eligible are not receiving benefits. So here's the United States government sitting there just begging to hand out welfare to all the poor slobs out there who are just useless morons. And the government here is saying, we're just not reaching enough people. So who's the bigger moron? Is it the man who signs up for food stamps to feed his family? Because the government has, for a generation, stolen so much money and raised such a high tax burden that it's extremely difficult to make a living. Or is it the government that begs people to get on the dole? Well, the bigger moron is the guy who signs up for welfare, but the more evil entity in this equation is the government that hands out that welfare and undermines the masculinity and the spirituality of men and women all over the country. Anything else? Reuters says that enrollment in the SNAP program has set a record each month since December of 2008. And I think that at least in the eyes of the current occupants of the seats of power in Washington, D.C., that's a record they'd like to see broken every month. Welcome back, or welcome me back from the break. And as we delve back into the culture file, what's that he's saying? What's that? He's saying? Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Okay. Anyway, it's just a bumper. It doesn't have to really say anything. It doesn't have to really mean anything. All right. Now back into the culture file, we delve into the culture of finance. You remember the precipitous 1,000-point drop that we had in the stock market last week, and my, well, it wasn't my opinion, but it was my guarded opinion that perhaps the global economic collapse had begun, and that perhaps my 3 to 4 year theory that that we had 3 or 4 years before everything just tanked, maybe it was being sped up. Well, a story out of, well, out of Reuters asked who caused the sell-off last week, and they tell us in the Reuters article, the initial story that an errant trader caused last Thursday's mysterious stock market plunge isn't the only dubious hypothesis making the rounds. So I just want to note that last week I said I was not buying the fat finger theory, and now Reuters acknowledges that it is a dubious hypothesis. In other words, nobody's buying the idea that somebody on their BlackBerry hit a billion instead of a million. Nobody's buying that. It's just dubious. Now, as long as the origin of the rapid 1,000-point drop in the Dow remains unexplained, Reuters says, rumors and wild speculation will thrive. One big U.S. exchange operator said last Tuesday that, in fact, there is no smoking gun to explain what happened. Now, the fat finger theory has been largely discredited, according to Reuters. Investigators are now looking for intentional trades that may have set off a selling frenzy. So everybody's looking for something nefarious, someone who did something on purpose. And I don't discount that that's a possibility. I mean, anything from some sort of cyber attack or some economic attack by the enemies of liberty and freedom. Someone from the basement of the White House, maybe. Someone in Nancy Pelosi's office. I mean, you just never know. Hey, this story says that there are some theories that are even pointing to space aliens. Yes, someone from Barney Frank's office. But I still stick with my original contention that this entire house of cards is simply getting too shaky, and that we can probably expect these type of things to happen more and more in the future. And it doesn't make me feel good. But I'm not afraid anymore. I've been pre-disastered. Yeah, I was pre-disastered. I got laid off from a rather well-paying job back in November of 2008, and so I've managed to struggle through the worst of it without losing any of my kids or any of our pets or the house or the car or anything like that. And so we figure we can hold up against just about anything. And I suppose we shall see. More from the financial news. Out in Los Angeles, from NBC, in order to reduce the city's budget deficit, Los Angeles may soon stop repairing sidewalks. Yeah, sidewalks. Now, this month, according to NBC in Los Angeles, the city council will consider repealing a 1974 ordinance that made the city responsible for sidewalk repairs. The policy was initiated, oddly enough, with a federal grant that ran out of money long ago. So this is another example of the feds handing out the government cheese, luring people into a state of dependency upon them, and then abandoning them to their own devices. So Los Angeles, the money for this federal grant, it ran out in the 70s. But the city has continued because the people... Now, before that, the people were responsible for their own sidewalks and their own driveways, which I'm okay with that. Until the 70s, property owners were responsible for maintaining sidewalks. But this federal grant came along. City politicians looked to bamboozle the people, making them feel like they were taking care of them, said, we'll fix your sidewalks, don't worry about your driveways. And the federal money came in, made the politicians look good for an election cycle or two, then the money was gone. And then the people, now fat and happy with the city fixing their sidewalks and their driveways, they didn't want to give that up. And no politician had the nerve to touch the third rail of sidewalk and driveway maintenance in Los Angeles. And so the deficit spending on sidewalks and driveways that just continued to mount over the years. And now it's a part of the overall budget crisis that could literally, I mean, Los Angeles may never physically sink into the sea, but it is on the verge of being an economic sinkhole out there. LA has 10,750 miles of sidewalks. That's very impressive. I just wanted to quote that because, I mean, that seems like a lot of sidewalks. About 4,600 miles of that are in need of repairs right now. And from what we understand, that problem only continues to get worse day after day due to the second law of thermodynamics, popularly known as entropy. You might want to look that up if you went to public school. Anyway, the city estimates they need over $1 billion just to fix the sidewalks in Los Angeles. And there are several tens of billions of dollars, or is it hundreds of billions now? I forget. They're just, it's so sad. You know, this is really a microcosm of the federalization and the socialization of American culture overall. You can see it all right in this story about the sidewalks out in Los Angeles. The federal government has come along and handed out the government cheese and got everybody addicted. And now that the cheese is rotten, or they're out of cheese, or they're just keeping their cheese to themselves, or they're sending the cheese elsewhere, well, the rats don't know what to do, and the ship is sinking, and all of that. Can I think of another analogy? No, I better just move on. Let's go on into the culture file. Let's see here. Ah, from the education section, from the Associated Press, nationwide, about a third of first-year private college students in 07-08 had to take at least one remedial course, and at public two-year colleges, that number rises to about 42%. So the public high schools, the government high schools, are it sounds like they're just producing stupid children. And that may or may not be the case. Certainly the academic standards have slid over the years. That's certainly the case. But could it be that this generation is any more stupid or hard to educate than previous generations? I think not. I think the problem is systemic. And let's get a little more into the story. According to one education policy consultant, he says that the education establishment basically tells kids that if you don't get a college education, you're going to be a third-class citizen. And hence, colleges are now taking kids who in previous generations would not have gone to college. Everybody tells you you have to go to college. Well, that's just, it's a lie. You don't have to go to college. Yeah, I went and visited a college once. I've probably spent more time protesting on college campuses than I have actually attending classes. And I survived the Great Recession of 08. So you don't have to go to college. But our culture, you know, all the government, the cheese masters, they want to hand out government loans to kids who can go to college, and they want every kid to go to college because it's another way that they bamboozle the electorate to vote for them. Because here they come on their white horse, and they're the salvation for these poor, ignorant slobs. We can send your children to college so they don't have to be third-class citizens. And the morons, the majority, the moron majority, they vote for these people because they want the cheese. It's just sad. Anyway, some outside of the traditional education establishment favor an apprenticeship program similar to those offered in some European and Asian countries, where kids who maybe aren't academic whiz kids, instead of going to college and pulling the academic whiz kids down to their level academically and eating up government cheese for no good reason, well, they go to an apprenticeship. They learn to be a plumber or a carpenter or an auto mechanic, or they learn to build bombs and rockets. You know, actually do the physical labor involved. We need those too, for crying out loud. Anyway, so where was I? Well, the education system. What more need be said? Anyway, if you're thinking about sending your kid to college, well, just think very seriously about it. You know, is your kid fit to go to college? Is he the right temperament, the right mentality? Is he academically adept? Maybe he's better with his hands. You know, there's an awful lot of guys with master's degrees and PhDs. When a pipe starts leaking in their house, they don't know what to do. The roof starts leaking. They have no clue what to do. You know, but maybe they can cure cancer in the lab, but, you know, someone else needs to fix the leak in the roof. And there's honor in the trades. All right. But there's no honor in the government school system. It's just sad. And it's handicapping children at both ends of the spectrum. And it just need not be that way. All right. Now let's move on to the culture file. A story from the ACLU, or I'm sorry, a story about the ACLU from Reuters. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed lawsuits arguing that the right to use profanity is protected by the U.S. Constitution. Marriott Tuthill of the ACLU of Pennsylvania says, quote, "Unfortunately, many police departments do not seem to be getting the message that swearing is not a crime. The courts have repeatedly found that profanity, unlike obscenity, is protected speech." Oh, but by the way, we're willing to defend obscenity as well. We're the ACLU. Unquote. Oh, well, actually, I threw that last part in. Marieke Tuthill did not actually say that they're willing to defend obscenity, but the ACLU has a long record of defending obscenity, so why she's making the distinction is, well, for purely political reasons here. Let's see. According to this article, at least 750 people in Pennsylvania face disorderly conduct charges because of the use of profanity each year there in Pennsylvania. The ACLU says it has successfully defended about a dozen people in profanity prosecutions. The ACLU has stated it will continue to bring lawsuits until the practice of issuing citations for swearing is stopped. Yeah. And once they get finished with swearing, they'll move on to child pornography and obscenity, which they support as well. The American Civil Liberties Union is dead set on removing any vestige of civility left in our culture, which is odd because they call themselves the Civil Liberties Union, and they've proven time and time again that they're against even the simplest forms of civility. Second, I'm still trying to get into the groove here, you know, with my foot up on this thing and in this brace and with the pain shooting through the ankle. I'm just having some difficulty. Perhaps I should have taken medications before going on the air. Perhaps that was a minor miscalculation. But I will do my best. All right, let's move. More from the culture file. The deteriorating culture made a lot of news this past week, and I'm here to bring it to you if you can stand it. Dateline Long Beach, California. From the Associated Press, 7 years after the Episcopal Church caused an uproar by consecrating its first openly homosexual bishop, it has done the same thing again, only this time with a woman. Just to put a twist on it, keep things fresh over there at the Episcopal Church. Now it's a lesbian that they have ordained as a bishop. The Right Reverend Canon Mary Glasspool of Baltimore, America's worst city, was ordained and consecrated last Saturday, making her the second openly gay bishop in church history. Now that doesn't mean she's a happy bishop who gets up there and leads people in happy gay worship. It means she's a homosexual who basically desecrates the pulpit every time she steps her deviant feet into it. So there the Episcopals. Oh, by the way, breakaway Episcopal conservatives have formed a rival church, the Anglican Church in North America, where they don't want any open homos preaching from the pulpit. And this reminds me of a discussion I had with a young gentleman out there in Las Vegas over this past week. He asked the question, should we hate homosexuals? Are homosexuals all going to hell? He had a few questions. And I'm of the opinion that we should not hate homosexuals. Now, people who advocate homosexuality and try to tell other people, especially children, that homosexuality is good, those people we should hate. And are all homosexuals going to hell? Well, this is what I tried to explain to this young man who had, I think, some honest questions about Christianity and God's standard of morality. Are all homosexuals going to hell? Well, the Bible says that if you are identified as a homosexual, then you'll have no part in the kingdom of God. And it lists a whole bunch of other sins. And the question is, what does it mean to be identified as a homosexual? Because I told him, you know, the Bible also says if your brother sins and repents, forgive him. And if he falls seven times, forgive him seven times. If he falls 77 times, forgive him those 77 times. So how do you reconcile that in a young, relatively ignorant person's mind who's honestly seeking to understand God's morality? And I believe the scripture indicates that those who are identified as sinners are those who are unrepentant in their sin, even proud of their sin. And in fact, those who advocate the particular sin with which they have identified themselves, they advocate that sin to other people. See, that's what God hates. God understands that a man is sinful and that he'll do the wrong thing. But if he repents and he's sorry and he humbles himself and he doesn't want to do those things, then God can find it in his heart to forgive him because of the work that Jesus Christ has done, the work that Jesus Christ completed. But if you advocate, if you want to identify yourself as a homosexual and you want to be open about it and you want people to accept it and you don't acknowledge that it's sinful, then, well, you're going to hell. So there. You know, but if you sin, whatever the sin is, if you're ashamed of it and it's not something you want to do, it's something that you fall and you miss the mark and you're sinful, but you're certainly not an advocate of it, and you acknowledge that you need Jesus Christ because you're simply incapable of escaping sin of your own accord, well, then God will forgive you if you're honest about it and you're sincere. So, how did we get, we were talking about the Episcopals. So, the Right Reverend Canon Mary Glasspool, as of this moment, if she dropped dead, straight to hell with jet rockets. Yeah, that's right. Just so there's no confusion. All right. Now, speaking of deviants from Cannes, France, Woody Allen, who is 74 years old. Can you believe that Woody Allen is 74? My goodness, time is flying and we're all getting old. You know, the Bible talks about your life. The life of a man is like a vapor of smoke. It's here and then it's gone. And every day, that comes home to me more and more when I start hearing from old friends and learning that they have 21-year-old children and finding out that Woody Allen is 74 years old and going out to play beach volleyball and realizing that my exuberance and my my desire to be competitive and to win is now taking second place to my physical capacity, which is deteriorating day by day, due again to that ever-popular second law of thermodynamics, entropy. Now, Woody Allen, 74, there in Cannes, France, he said that Roman Polanski has paid a high price for his actions and that it was time to draw a line under the case. So And I think that means Woody wants us to put the case behind Mr. Polanski. You'll all remember that Roman Polanski was convicted of assaulting an underage girl, and he fled to France, where apparently that type of thing is not frowned upon, at least in official circles. But Woody Allen had a lot to say at the Cannes Film Festival. It basically overshadowed the festival, and not just because the films are so crappy these days, but also because the whole Polanski thing has just kind of overshadowed everything, as well it should. With all the arts crowd, these type of incidents, they should overshadow everything these deviants do. And it's good to see that happening at Cannes. But Woody Allen says of the Roman Polanski controversy, he says, "It's something that happened many years ago. He has suffered. He has paid his due. He's an artist. He's a nice person. He did something wrong, and he paid for it. His critics are not happy unless he pays for the rest of his life. They would be happy if they could execute him with a firing squad." And right there, Woody hit on it. Yes, we would be happy if we could execute Mr. Polanski via a firing squad. Yes, that's what we want. And you know, that would be the best thing for Mr. Polanski. Because as of right now, I don't know that Mr. Polanski realizes what he's done and how serious it is. But one thing that will relate to you how serious your crime is when five men point rifles at you and announce that they're about to blow your brains out for it. At that point, Mr. Polanski might realize what a serious crime he had committed. And then, and only then, is there a possibility he might repent of his crime and stop identifying himself as a sinner and ask for forgiveness. Hollywood star Michael Douglas, who was in Cannes to promote some crappy movie, said that he would not sign a petition against Polanski's extradition. Yeah, so Michael Douglas. I mean, Michael Douglas is probably about as deviant a leftist scumbag as you can imagine. I don't know the guy, haven't followed his politics. I'm just assuming that he's an unrepentant, unregenerate heathen, self-worship type freak, Hollywood scumbag. That's what I assume about Michael Douglas. But even he knows that you can't let a guy get away with assaulting an underage girl and then flee justice and mock justice. I mean, even an vacuous Hollywood empty suit like Michael Jackson, or did I say Michael Jackson? Like Michael Douglas, even he knows that you can't do that. Now, the festival president said that there is the filmmaker and the citizen. The filmmaker is a great filmmaker, but there is the citizen. No one is above the law. So there you go, the guy in Cannes. He's French, and even he knows no one is above the law. And you know, that's not just a temporal statement. That's a spiritual, eternal statement. No one is above the law. No human being is above the law. So, by the way, Woody Allen, at the age of 61, married his 27-year-old daughter in 1997. Just so you have an idea where Woody's coming from. Yeah. All right. Now let's move on into the culture file. Let's see. I don't care about that story. Now this is just interesting. From the finance page at Yahoo in Des Moines, Iowa. This is from the Associated Press. Nine people were indicted last Wednesday on federal charges of accessing President Barry Ho's student loan records while they are employed for a Department of Education contractor there in the state of Iowa. All nine people are charged with exceeding authorized computer access. They are accused of accessing President Barack Hussein Obama's student loan records while he was either a candidate or the president-elect or the president. Arraignments are scheduled for May 24th. The charge is punishable by up to 1 year in prison and a fine of up to $1,000 for snooping on Barry's student loan records. So I'm all for punishing people for snooping where they shouldn't be snooping. Don't get me wrong. My question is, why couldn't they find the records? I mean, you got nine people snooping, and none of them can find out how it was Barry got his federal loans. I mean, it just begs the question. All right, speaking of begging the question, let's move into the politics file. Oh, I guess we already did that. Yes, that story was from the politics file, but I'm a bit disappointed this week. Let's go to the Bloomberg Wire. Republicans serve notice that they will highlight Elena Kagan's lack of experience and the little time she has worked as a courtroom lawyer to say that she's not qualified to sit on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States. That's what Republicans are going to say. She's simply not experienced enough. She hasn't worked as a lawyer enough. That's going to be the Republican tack. So what does that tell us? Well, guaranteed slam dunk, Elena Kagan will be confirmed because the Republicans are simply pathetic. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy says she will be confirmed. Mr. Leahy, I hate you, but I couldn't agree more. She will be confirmed. Now, the Republicans will not bring up a number of other issues for which she truly, I mean, the fact that someone's not a lawyer, that should be a qualification to put them on the Supreme Court. The fact that they have a lack of experience working in the justice system, that should burnish their bona fides to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, they're obviously less corrupt than the nine deviants who are on there right now. Did I say nine deviants? Well, I guess they're all nine, not total deviants. But they are lawyers, so there. Keep that in mind. Anyway, the thing I'm most disappointed about this week is that Paul Shanklin over at Rush Limbaugh's show has already noted that Elena Kagan bears a striking resemblance to Chastity Bono. I thought I was going to be the one to break that news. But since I only do a weekly show, and you got to admit, Paul Shanklin is pretty funny guy, pretty witty. But it also doesn't take a genius to notice the incredible resemblance. I'm looking at these photos. I'm going to have to put these up on the blog because I don't know that anyone has done it to put Elena Kagan side by side with Chastity Bono post-op. And then you be the judge if they are not the same person. All right. Abortion, according to the Washington Post, could be a sleeper issue in the Supreme Court confirmation process. Here's what they say. Abortion, says the Washington Post, is an issue that has faded from the political forefront during this past year's economic crises, but Kagan's take on Roe v. Wade could become a sleeper issue. A sleeper issue? What is the only issue every time there's an appointment to the Supreme Court? The only issue is abortion. It is the only issue, and it's talked about incessantly. It's not a sleeper issue. And the reason is that everyone in the abortion industry, everyone associated with it, everyone making money off it, everyone seducing women with it, all of them know that it is just this bare judiciary sleight of hand that keeps legal the right of one person to murder another innocent person. They know that. And once that sleight of hand is revealed, it will all come crashing down. So the one thing they're concerned about when someone is put on the court is their view on abortion. It's not a sleeper issue. Washington Post. It's the issue. It's the only reason the Supreme Court really matters at this point. The article points out that a 1997 memorandum authored by Kagan supported the phony partial birth abortion ban, or at least a compromise on that ban, to then-President Bubba Bill Jeff Clinton. So isn't it funny how... You know, this supposedly pro-life legislation, the partial birth abortion ban, you all remember that. How many of us donated money to it? You remember? Isn't it funny how that supposedly pro-life legislation now gives cover to a rabid pro-abort like Elena Kagan? I mean, everybody knows where she stands, but she can point and she can say, look, I supported that. I supported the president compromising so that we could ban partial birth abortion. My views on abortion are, I'm open-minded. Yeah. Anyway, so we'll see. We shall see how the abortion issue rears its ugly head. By the way, the Obama appointment of Elena Chaz Kagan, if she's confirmed, as I predict she will be, the result will be that there will be not a single Protestant on the Supreme Court. Can you believe it? Our country was founded by the Pilgrims who were escaping persecution. They were the definition of Protestantism. America has been the fruit of the Protestant Reformation, frankly. And now there's not a single Protestant on the Supreme Court. And I must just say, I think it's an appropriate epitaph for the long-dead mainline Protestant denominations.
The devil says...
I'm your humble host, Doug McBurney. We're rounding third and headed to home. We're running out of time, so let's continue on now as we move into the personhood file. We're going to start with a Fox News story out of the Mojave Desert in California. 7-foot-tall metal cross on a 75-year-old war memorial was ripped down and stolen last Sunday night. According to Kelly Shackelford, president of the Liberty Institute... she says, this is an outrage akin to desecrating people's graves. It's a disgraceful attack on the selfless sacrifice of our veterans. We will not rest until this memorial is reinstalled. All right, and you know, I'm okay with them being upset about the memorial. It's not good that some leftist scum, although... Let's read from the authorities had no immediate motive for the theft, but National Park Service officials are considering a range of ideas from scrap metal scavengers to people with an interest in the Supreme Court case. You'll remember the Supreme Court ruled that the cross could stay there. So I think it's even odds that someone who just wanted it to scavenge it for scrap is just as likely as some ACLU attorney to have stolen this cross. But what gets me is the outrage and shock portrayed on talk radio this week regarding this case. I mean, symbolically, it has some symbolic value. It's a story that should be talked about. But for now, the Liberty Institute to say we will not rest until this cross is restored. And for talk radio hosts to devote... how many hours of talk to this week? In the midst of a time when a movement has been launched to defend innocent people in our country from being murdered. There's an entire class of citizens who are being dehumanized and murdered legally, and a movement has arisen to stop that. How many hours of talk have the major right-wing Rush bots, the Limb bots, the Rush clones, how many hours have they devoted to the personhood movement that could save the very soul of the nation and change the face of politics and culture as we know it? Yet you rip down a cross in the desert, and they shall not rest. Anyway, I just don't understand some people's priorities. But maybe that's why they have big nationwide shows. Is because they avoid certain uncomfortable topics. Or at least they will for a while, until the topic becomes something that is useful to them. Case in point, from the Grand Junction Sentinel, here in Colorado, the last time the Personhood Amendment made the Colorado ballot, a number of anti-abortion Republican leaders either distanced themselves from it outright, or they opposed the idea because they said it went too far. None of that seems to be the case with the 2010 version of the measure, according to the Grand Junction Sentinel. As a result, all of the top GOP candidates for governor and the Senate have publicly supported the ballot question that would declare that life begins at conception. So all of us here in Colorado involved in the personhood effort were relatively shocked to hear that that the gubernatorial and the Senate candidates had all endorsed Amendment 62. Because in 2008, and the Grand Junction Sentinel confirms it right here, Senate candidate Bob Schaefer and Colorado Republican Party Chairman Dick Wadhams were outspoken critics of the same ballot question just 2 years ago. So when I saw the story, I was about to go on the air out on AM 670, guest hosting for Bob Inyart. And for you, those here in Denver, I will be doing some of that again this week. So be sure to tune us in. 3 o'clock on the Blowtorch, AM 670. But as I was about to go on the air, I saw the story, and I frankly didn't believe it. I wasn't going to do it because I wanted to check it out first. I thought it might be from The Onion. But it turns out, Dick Wadhams, according to The Sentinel, says he believes that the climate has changed sufficiently that supporting personhood in 2010 won't hurt Republicans. So, methinks me smells a bit of primary politics here. Each so-called conservative Republican trying to outdo the other Republican in their conservative bona fides, so they step up now and claim that they support personhood. How long after the nomination of the Republican Party is secured will they abandon us? Well, we should start a pool, because I think it'll be within 24 hours. But maybe I'm just pessimistic and jaded. And maybe these Republicans have seen the light. What do you think? Let's see here. Oh, so this article, by the way, the Colorado Independent, which is a liberal rag out here, the reporter says, candidates who support personhood, whether they believe it'll help them or not, in actuality will have it hung around their necks in November. If played well, this personhood issue could be just the motivator Colorado Democrats need to get their Obama majority back to the polls. So, I mean, I just got to ask myself, are Democrats really that motivated by making sure that we keep killing babies legal? Are they that motivated that would actually motivate them to go to the polls? I really don't see it. I mean, I know you've got that segment of the Democratic Party that are just, they're just rabid. They're so depressed anytime they hear someone didn't have an abortion. I mean, there are some of those, but it's a very small minority. Most people who've been involved in abortion are ashamed of it. And it's not a real rah-rah, fire-up-the-troops issue for all you Democrats, sluts, and perverts out there. I just don't see it happening. But regardless, we shall see how long the Republicans stay on board the personhood, well, what has become a personhood bandwagon, at least during the primaries. More on that from the Huffington Post. Gubernatorial Colorado candidate Scott McInnes raised eyebrows last week when he declared his support for a controversial ballot initiative that many say would effectively ban abortion in the state of Colorado. In a Tuesday Independent article, McInnes spokesman Sean Duffy even denied that McInnes was ever a part of Republicans for Choice. This is one of the reasons I didn't believe the story. I knew McInnes had been a member of Republicans for Choice. I knew he was a pro-abort. But his spokesman comes out and says he was never a part of that, Republicans for Choice. Well, the Denver Post has produced a letter from Republicans for Choice, dated 1998, and Scott McInnes' name is in the letterhead as a member of the organization. But McInnes says, I may have been pro-choice many, many years ago, but since I'm running for governor, I am 100% pro-life. 100%. You know, if you have to say you're 100% pro-life, you might not understand what it means to be pro-life. Because to be pro-life already means you're 100% pro-life. That means you don't want to kill any innocent people, Scott. You don't have to say 100%. Let your yes be yes, your no be no. Let your pro-life be pro-life. Methinks me smells something fishy in the McInnes clan over there in the Republican primary. Anyway, McInnes' campaign has deflected criticism that he changed his position in order to endear himself to the right wing. They explain that it's life experiences that were behind his gradual shift on the issue. My goodness. Sounds like Mitt Romney campaign, for crying out loud. I mean, are we going to buy that again? Well, wait a minute. We didn't buy Mitt Romney the last time. Anyway, we're running out of time. What can I... Oh, what's going on in Thailand? You've been seeing the riots in Thailand, right? Here's a story from the Washington Post. Bangkok. Thailand's leader defended a deadly army crackdown on protesters. They've been shooting them. They've been setting up snipers and shooting the protesters. And all of the news outlets, from Fox News all the way over to CBS, are all reporting it as a government crackdown on protesters. Which, in the American vernacular, we don't like government crackdowns on protesters, right? We're Americans. The right to be a protester is somewhat honorable here in America. So, by the news media doing this, has anyone talked about the fact that the protesters are called the red shirt protesters? They're communists. They're communist protesters. Nobody talks about it. You have to... What's that? Oh, Savage mentioned it? Okay. Well, I had to dig through 50 internet web pages to find one mention of the fact that these are a bunch of leftist communist agitators. No one's reporting it. All right, we'll give Savage his due. Everybody beats me to the story this week. I gotta get a daily show, but the only way I can do that is if someone offers to pay me to do this. Because this ain't easy, folks. All right. Anyway, the red shirts, they're communist agitators led by community organizers right out of the Alinsky playbook, and they might have hung around with Barack Obama in the 90s in Chicago, for crying out loud. Anyway, so there you have it. In case you hadn't heard, they're communists, for crying out loud. All right, that's it. We're almost out of time. Oh, here we go. From the New York Times, U.S. troops in Afghanistan could soon be awarded a medal for courageous restraint. I can't even say that with a straight face. This is not a story from The Onion. This is real news. Oh, it's not the New York Times. It's the Navy Times. Oh, it's worse than I thought. It's definitely true. I thought if it was the New York Times, at least we could assume it could be. Anyway, the proposal is now circulating in the Kabul headquarters for a medal for courageous restraint for holding fire to save civilian lives. Now, the Navy Times says that most of the highest U.S. military decorations are for valor in combat. A medal to recognize a conscious effort to avoid combat action would be unique. Unique? Unbelievable. One official says, hey, we absolutely support the right of our forces to defend themselves. Valuing restraint in a potentially dangerous situation is not the same thing as denying troops the right to employ lethal force when they determine it's necessary. Defend themselves? I think our military leaders have lost track of what the military is for. The military does not go into places to defend themselves. They go in to execute vengeance and wrath and death and destruction on the enemy. They're not there to defend themselves. Not only do they have the right to defend themselves, they have the right to kill other people. It's the military. Anyway, I guess we'll see. What are the odds that this medal gets approved? I mean, I think the odds are pretty good. All right. Let's move on, finally, from the Telegraph in London. Yang Li Wei is a 44-year-old military pilot. He commanded the Shenzhou 5 mission to space for the Chinese in 2003. He's written an autobiography called The Nine Levels Between Heaven and Earth. He says, many of my friends are curious about what we eat in space, and they think astronauts must have some expensive delicacies like shark fin or abalone. He says, actually, we ate quite normal food, and there's no need to keep it secret. The menu was basic stuff. Braised chicken, steamed fish, and dog meat. That's right. The Chinese astronauts eat dog meat in space. The menu, by the way, was still in use last year when Chinese astronauts conducted their first ever spacewalks. China has plans to land a man on the moon by 2020. So I can see it now, right? One small step for a man, but you should see how fast the first dog on the moon ran when the Chinese got there. All right, that's the worldview for this week. Join us again next week. Until I'll be back with you. I want to thank my other brother, Darryl, for helping make it all happen here. And I want to thank my extremely attractive audio engineer for bearing with me once again. I'll be back with you next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.